The use of "thus I have heard" comes from instructions given to Ananda by the Buddha just before the Buddha entered Nirvana. One day, Shakyamuni Buddha announced, "Tonight, in the middle of the night, I am going to enter Nirvana." When Ananda heard this, he was so distraught that he cried like a baby for its mother and called, "Buddha, Buddha, please don't enter Nirvana. Please don't cast us all aside." He cried and pleaded until his brain got addled, probably because he thought that this was what he should be doing. Just then a blind man came by, one unlike other blind men. His ordinary eyes were blind, but his heavenly eye was open. Because he was blind, he wasn't burdened with a lot of false thinking, and his mind was very clear. "Venerable one," he said, addressing Ananda, "why are you crying?" "The Buddha is about to enter Nirvana," Ananda replied. "How can I hold back my tears?" The eyeless elder replied, "How can you do your work if you cry? After the Buddha enters Nirvana, we will have to establish many things. There is work to be done and questions to be asked."
"What questions?" said Ananda. "The Buddha is going to Nirvana. What is there left to do? What could be more important than the Buddha's Nirvana?"
The blind man, whose name was Aniruddha, and who was foremost in the capacity of the heavenly eyes, said, "There are four extremely important matters which must be settled."
"What are they?" asked Ananda.
"Compiling the sutras is one," he said. "With what words should we begin each sutra?"
"True," said Ananda. "That is important. It's a good thing you brought it up. I never would have thought of it myself. All I can think of is the Buddha going to Nirvana. What is the second question I should ask?"
The Venerable Aniruddha said, "We have taken the Buddha as our teacher, but when he goes to Nirvana, who will be our teacher? Should we look for another teacher?"
"Right, right," said Ananda. "We should find another good teacher. You're quite right. What is the third?"
Aniruddha said, "Now we live with the Buddha, but when he goes to Nirvana, where will we live?"
"That is very important," said Ananda. "Without a place to live, how can we cultivate the way? Should we find someplace else to live? These three matters are extremely important. What is the fourth?"
Aniruddha said, "The Buddha can discipline evil-natured bhikshus, but after he goes to Nirvana, how shall we take care of them?" "Now, an evil-natured bhikshu does nothing but disturb other people. If you meditate, he walks around, clomp, clomp, making a lot of noise so that no one can enter samadhi. When people are walking, he sits to meditate. 'Look at me,' he says, 'I sit much better than all of you,' and pretends to have entered samadhi. When people are bowing to the Buddha, the evil-natured bhikshu likes to recite sutras, and when people are reciting sutras, he likes to bow to the Buddha. In general, he's got to have a special style, the evil-natured bhikshu style, and he does not follow the rules. If everyone goes one way, he goes the opposite way. He has no consideration for anyone else but expects everyone to notice him. 'He's terrific,' everyone says. 'He really cultivates. He insists on being special so that others will notice him and say that he is the best. Fiercely competitive, he must be the strongest, outstanding among the best. He stands like an asura with his hands on his hips as if to say, 'See what a great hero I am.' He has to be different and outdo everyone else. When the Buddha was in the world, he could control such evil-natured bhikshus
and they obeyed his instructions. But after he entered Nirvana, who would supervise them? And who could control the evil nature layman who says, "Look at me, I'm more dedicated than all of you other laymen"? Actually, it's just because of him and his special style that no one else is dedicated. Aniruddha said, "When the Buddha goes to Nirvana, what are we going to do with the evil-natured bhikshus and evil-natured laymen?" "These are important questions," said Ananda. "I'll go ask right away." He wiped his eyes, blew his nose, and ran off to the Buddha. "Buddha, great master," he said, "I have 4 questions which I would like to ask you before you go to Nirvana."
"World-honored one, won't you be compassionate and answer them?"
"All right," said the Buddha.
"Buddha," said Ananda, "you have spoken many sutras. When we compile and edit them, with what words should they begin?"
The Buddha said, "All sutras spoken by the Buddhas of the past, present, and future begin with the words, 'Thus I have heard,' which means, 'The Dharma which is thus can be believed. I personally heard it.'"
Ananda said, "Secondly, you are our master. When you enter Nirvana, who will be our teacher? Please instruct us. Should it be Mahakashyapa?"
The Buddha said, "No. When I go to Nirvana, take the Pratimoksha, the precepts, as your teacher. To accord with the Buddha's instructions, those who leave home must first receive the precepts." Then Ananda said, "We have always lived with you, Buddha, but when you enter Nirvana, where are we going to live?"
Shakyamuni Buddha said, "When I go to Nirvana, all bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas and upasikas should dwell in the 4 applications of mindfulness. Mindfulness with regard to the body, feelings, thoughts, and dharmas. 1. Contemplate the body as impure. If you know that the body is impure, you won't love it, and without love, there will be no attachment. Being without attachment is freedom. So first of all, regard the body as impure. 2. Contemplate feelings as suffering. Feelings are all a kind of suffering, whether they are pleasant or unpleasant. For pleasant feelings are the cause of unpleasant feelings. 3. Contemplate thought as impermanent. Thoughts shift and flow and are not permanent. 4. Contemplate dharmas as devoid of self. Ananda further asked, "How should we treat evil-natured bhikshus?" The Buddha said, "That is no problem at all. Simply be silent and they will go away. Fight evil people with concentration power. Don't be moved by them. If they are evil, don't be evil in return. If a mad dog bites you and you bite him back, you're just a dog yourself. Evil-natured people are born with bad tempers. All you can do is ignore them, and they will soon lose interest and leave." "Oh," said Ananda, "it's really very simple."
Why did the Buddha tell Ananda to use the 4 words, "Thus I have heard"? These 4 words have 3 meanings. 1. To distinguish Buddhist sutras from the writings of other religions. Non-Buddhist religions in India began their texts with the words A or O, which means non-existence or existence.
As these opposing religions see it, all dharmas in heaven and earth either exist or do not exist. If it is not non-existent, they say, then it exists. And if it doesn't exist, then it's non-existent. In general, as far as they can see, nothing goes beyond existence and non-existence. In the beginning, there wasn't anything, they write, but now there is. None of these religions speaks of true emptiness and wonderful existence. Their doctrines may resemble them somewhat, but they don't explain them in detail. Buddhist sutras are thus. They are just that way. The Dharma is just that way. You ask, what is not that way? Everything is that way. If you question it and say, what is that way? Then nothing is that way. Thus is extremely wonderful. The words, thus I have heard, distinguish Buddhist sutras from the writings of other religions. 2. To resolve the doubts of the assembly. The Buddha knew that everyone would have doubts. After the Buddha's nirvana, while Ananda and Mahakashyapa were editing the sutras, Ananda sat on the Dharma seat to speak the Dharma. Seeing him sitting on the Buddha's seat, the members of the assembly suddenly gave rise to 3 doubts. A. Some thought, Shakyamuni Buddha hasn't completed the stillness. He hasn't gone to nirvana. Our master lives. They thought Ananda was Shakyamuni Buddha come back to life. B. Others thought, Shakyamuni Buddha has already entered nirvana. This must be a Buddha from another direction, north, east, south, or west. C. No, said others. The great master has gone to nirvana. He hasn't come back to life, and the Buddhas of the other directions teach people in other directions. They would never come all the way to the Saha world. Why, Ananda himself must have realized Buddhahood. The assembly held these 3 doubts until Ananda said, thus I have heard. As soon as he said them, everyone knew that Shakyamuni Buddha hadn't come back. They knew it was not a Buddha from another direction, and that Ananda had not become a Buddha. The Dharma, which is thus, is that which Ananda personally heard from Shakyamuni Buddha. 3 doubts suddenly arose, and 4 words resolved them. 3. To end the assembly's debates. Of all the great bhikshus, Ananda was the youngest. He was born on the day Shakyamuni Buddha realized Buddhahood, and when the Buddha went to nirvana, Ananda was only 49 years old. Why was Ananda selected to explain and edit the sutras? Old Kashyapa was the eldest, and Madhgalayana and Shariputra were both of higher status than Ananda. There were many others in the assembly with more way virtue and learning than him. He was the youngest, and it was likely that no one would believe in him and that many would try to be first. One might say, I've heard more sutras than you, so I should explain them. But when Ananda said, thus I have heard, everyone knew that these were not Ananda's principles, or the principles of the great assembly. This is the Dharma which I, Ananda, personally heard the Buddha speak. It is not your teaching, and not my teaching. It is our master's teaching. You are not first, and I am not first.
This silenced the assembly's debates.
The four applications of mindfulness.
1. Contemplate the body as impure.
Everyone sees his body as extremely precious. Because you think it is real, you are selfish and profit-seeking. Without a body, there would be no selfishness.
We think our bodies are real and actual. Being selfish, we create offenses and commit evil deeds.
We cannot let go of the affairs of the world and calculate on behalf of our bodies all day long, looking for good food, beautiful clothes, and a nice place to live. A little happiness for the body.
On the day we die, we are still unclear.
"My body is dying," we moan. "How can it do this to me?"
At that time, we know that our bodies are unreal, but it's too late. Too late for our regrets.
Ultimately, is the body real?
Stupid people think so, but wise people see it merely as a combination of the four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. It is not ultimate.
Then, you ask, what is ultimate?
Our own self-nature is bright and all-illumining. Our own self-nature is perfect and unimpeded. It is nowhere, and nowhere it is not. To the end of empty space, it exhausts the Dharma realm.
Our bodies are temporary dwellings where our self-nature comes to live for a time.
But the person dwelling in the hotel is not the hotel, and in the same way, his body is not him.
The traveler who thinks that he is in the hotel is mistaken.
If you know that the body is just like a hotel, you should seek that which dwells within it, for once you have found it, you will recognize your true self.
From the time of birth, the body is impure, a combination of its father's semen and its mother's blood. The child grows up with greed, hate, stupidity, pride, and doubt. He commits offenses, creating the karma of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and taking intoxicants and drugs. Offense karma is created because of the body.
But is the body such a precious thing after all?
No.
A precious jewel is pure and undefiled, without stain or the slightest trace of filth.
Our bodies, on the other hand, have 9 apertures which constantly secrete impure substances: tears from the eyes, wax from the ears, mucus from the nose.
There are religions whose members eat mucus. They say that they are smelting the cinnabar. They also eat tears and earwax, thinking that these filthy substances are precious jewels. Isn't that pitiful?
2 ears, 2 eyes, and 2 nostrils make 6 holes. The mouth is full of phlegm and saliva. That's 7 holes. Add the anus and the urinary tract and you have 9.
Would you call this pure?
Everyone knows that excrement and urine are unclean, and if you don't believe it, just try seasoning some fine food with a tiny pinch of excrement. No one will eat it.
People will want to vomit instead because it is unclean.
Would you call this body dribbling filth from nine holes a jewel? If it's a jewel, why do such vile things flow from it? If you don't bathe for a week, you itch and squirm and a thick crust forms on your body. Where did it come from? Soon you stink with an odor even a dog finds repulsive. What is the advantage of having a body? Contemplate the body as impure. If you see how filthy it is, do you still love it? Are you still attached? What's the use of loving such a dirty thing? Then can I stab myself? Can I kill myself? You ask. No, that's not necessary. You must borrow this false body and use it to cultivate the truth. The self nature dwells within the body. You enter the body of five skandhas and the yin and yang merged in a combination of purity and filth, which is your body. If you cultivate, you can go up and attain purity. If you do not cultivate, you will go down, create offenses, unite with filth, and turn into a ghost. Go up. Become a Buddha. Whether or not you cultivate is up to you, however. Nobody can force you to cultivate. The Venerable Ananda thought that because he was the Buddha's cousin, he didn't need to cultivate. He thought that the Buddha would just give him samadhi. But the Buddha couldn't do that, and so it was not until after the Buddha's nirvana, when Ananda was about to edit the sutras, that he finally certified to the fourth stage of arhatship and realized that he could not neglect cultivation. Be mindful that the body is impure. Don't be so fond of it, and don't take it as a treasure. You say, I can't stand criticism. I can't stand it. Who are you? If they hit me, I can't bear it. It hurts. Really? If you put your attachments down and see through them, there is neither pain nor not pain. Who is in pain? What exactly hurts? If someone hits you, pretend that you bumped into a wall. If someone scolds you, pretend that they are singing a song or speaking Japanese. How can they scold you if you don't understand them? Are they speaking Spanish or Portuguese? French? German? I've never studied languages, so I don't understand. They can scold you, but it's nothing. In general, once you see through, break and put down the attachment to your body, you win your independence. Contemplate your body as impure. Don't regard it with so much importance. It's not important. Contemplate feelings, thoughts, and dharmas as impure also. 2. Contemplate feelings as suffering. Feelings may be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. From the point of view of the three sufferings, unpleasant feelings are the suffering within suffering. Pleasant feelings are caught up in the suffering of decay, and neutral feelings are the suffering of process. Wake up! Everything you enjoy is a form of suffering. If you know that pleasure is suffering, you will not be attached to it. I often say, enduring suffering puts an end to suffering. Enjoying blessings destroys blessings. If you endure your suffering, it will pass. If you enjoy your blessings, they too will pass. Contemplate feelings as suffering. The body, thought, and dharmas are also suffering. Although there are four applications of mindfulness,
You can divide them up. Each of the four characteristic qualities, impurity, suffering, impermanence, and the absence of self, can be applied to the body, to feelings, to thoughts, and to dharmas, making 16 applications in all. 3. Contemplate thoughts as impermanent. The Vajra Sutra says, "Past thought cannot be obtained. Present thought cannot be obtained, and future thought cannot be obtained. All your thoughts are unobtainable. They flow without stopping, and so they are impermanent. The body, feelings, and dharmas are also impermanent." 4. Contemplate dharmas as without self. Basically, there are no dharmas. Where does the self come from? The self is a combination of the four elements and the five skandhas, a creation of form dharmas. Outside of the four elements and the five skandhas, there is no self. So contemplate dharmas as being without a self. The four applications of mindfulness are very wonderful. If you investigate them thoroughly, understand and dwell on them, you will be unattached and will attain true freedom. If you are attached, you can't be free. Why? Because you're attached. So dwell in the four applications of mindfulness. Dwell and yet do not dwell. Ananda's fourth question concerned evil-natured bhikshus. The Buddha said, "Be silent, and they will leave." Even while the Buddha was in the world, there were evil-natured bhikshus, laymen, and ordinary people. "If you ignore them," the Buddha said, "they will get bored and leave." "Thus I have heard." Thus fills the requirement of 1. Faith. The Dharma which is thus can be believed. Dharma which is not thus cannot be believed. "I have heard" fills the requirement of 2. Hearing. Since the ears do the hearing, you may ask, why does it say, "I have heard"? This is because whereas the ears are just a small part of the body, "I" refers to the whole person. At one time fills the requirement of 3. Time. Why, you may ask, doesn't the sutra give the month, day, and year? Calendars differ from nation to nation. Some countries begin the year in the first month, some in the second or third month of another country's calendar. There is no way to indicate the date, and what is more, if the date were given, people would start doing research to determine if it was correct. Because the sutra only states, "at one time," there is no demand for historical verification. In order to speak the Dharma, there must be an 4. Audience. In this case, it was the gathering of great bhikshus. The audience must also have the time to come and listen, for if they don't stay, of what use is their faith? They must have the time to listen. They must want to hear the Dharma, and they must believe in it. Then there must also be a Dharma-speaking host. In this case, the Buddha is the 5 host, and the 6 places Shravasti in the garden of the benefactor of orphans and the solitary.
Therefore, in the opening sentences of the sutra, all six requirements are fulfilled. Shravasti is the name of a city in India. Translated, it means abundance and virtue. Because the seven jewels, gold, silver, lapis lazuli, crystal, mother of pearl, red pearls and carnelian, and the objects of the five desires, beauty, wealth, fame, food, and sleep, were in abundance there. The people of Shravasti were very intelligent and had the virtue of great learning and liberation. You could also say that the objects of the five desires are forms, sounds, smells, taste, and tangibles. The states connected with the objects of the five desires turn people's wisdom upside down. The eyes run off after forms, the ears after sounds, the nose after smells, the tongue after tastes, and the body after tangibles. Deluded people spin around and around in pursuit of the objects of the five desires. The people of Shravasti had great learning and refinement. They were also liberated, free, and unfettered, and were only slightly attached. In the Jeti Grove, in the garden of the benefactor of orphans and the solitary, Anuttabindata, whose name means benefactor of orphans and the solitary, was a wealthy elder who lived in the city of Shravasti. He was also known as Sudatta, which means joyous giving. He was a rich man, but he didn't understand the Buddha Dharma. In fact, he had never even heard the Buddha's name. One day, while arranging for his son's marriage, he visited a friend, the wealthy elder Shantanno. That night, Shantanno rose and began to decorate his house. Sudatta asked, "You're adorning the house so beautifully. Is there to be a celebration? Is your son going to be married?" "No," said Shantanno. "I have invited the Buddha to receive offerings." When Sudatta heard the word Buddha, every hair on his body stood straight up on end. "Who is the Buddha?" he gasped. "The Buddha is the crown prince, son of King Suddhodana. He would have been the king, but he left home to cultivate the way and became a Buddha instead. I have invited him here to receive offerings." Having heard the word Buddha, Sudatta couldn't get back to sleep. Shakyamuni Buddha knew that Sudatta's heart was sincere, and he emitted a light which shone so brightly that Sudatta thought it was dawn, got out of bed, and went out of the city. The city gate was locked, but the Buddha opened it with his spiritual powers, and Sudatta proceeded to the Buddha's dwelling in the bamboo grove. Just as Sudatta arrived, four gods descended, circumambulated the Buddha three times, and then bowed in order to show Sudatta the proper gestures of respect. Because Sudatta had never seen the Buddha or heard the Dharma, he followed the gods' example, and the Buddha explained the Dharma to him. Sudatta was delighted and said, "Buddha, you have so many followers, you really need a big place to live. I shall prepare one and invite you to live there." "Fine," said the Buddha. Sudatta looked, but he couldn't find the right land. Finally, he saw Prince Jetta's garden. It was big enough, but Prince Jetta refused to sell. "If you want to buy my garden," he laughed, "first cover it with gold coins. That's my price."
Sudatta didn't stay to bargain with him. He just said, "Okay," and moved his treasury piece by piece to the garden and covered the entire grove. "Now your garden belongs to me," he said to Prince Jetta.
"I was only joking," said the prince, annoyed. "I'm keeping it for myself. How could I sell it to you?"
"You told me that you would sell it if I covered it with gold, and I took you at your word," Sudatta said. "If you plan to be a king, you really shouldn't joke with people. A king's word must stand."
"Very well," said the prince. "You covered the ground with gold, so the park is yours, but you didn't cover the trees. The trees are mine, but I'll give them as a donation."
Because the trees belong to Prince Jetta, it is called the Jetta Grove, and because the garden was Sudatta's, it's called the Garden of the Benefactor of Orphans and the Solitary. In China, when King Wen established the nation, he assisted four kinds of poor people: widows, widowers, orphans, and the childless, or solitary. Sudatta also gave aid to these four kinds of people, and so he is known as the Benefactor of Orphans and the Solitary, that is, Anattabindada. Together with a gathering of great bhikshus, 1,250 in all. This phrase fulfills the audience requirement. Together means that they studied under the same teacher, lived in the same place, and investigated the Buddha Dharma together. They all had the same Bodhi mind and had opened the same wisdom, attained the same result, and would together realize Buddhahood. Because they had so much in common, the text reads, "Together." The sutra text first lists the assembly of sound hearers because they are sages who have transcended the world. The bodhisattvas are listed next because they are sometimes bhikshus and sometimes laymen. They cultivate the middle way, and so they are listed in the middle. The gods and dragons of the eightfold division are listed last because they are in the world and represent the common people. Sometimes the bodhisattvas are present in the Dharma assembly, and sometimes they travel to other worlds. The bhikshus, on the other hand, were the Buddha's constant followers. They always listen to the sutras and the Dharma, and so they are listed first. "Great" has three meanings. 1. Great. 2. Many. And 3. Victorious. Bhikshus are respected by kings and great men, and so they are great. They have cut off afflictions and destroyed the many evils. They are different from and victorious over all external religions. Bhikshu also has three meanings. 1. Seeker of alms food. 2. One who frightens Mara. And 3. Destroyer of evil. When one ascends the precept platform to be ordained, one's request for ordination may be granted after 3 appeals. An earthbound yaksha ghost informs a space-traveling yaksha who flies up to inform the heavenly demons. The heavenly demons are terrified and tell Mara, the king of the 6th desire heaven, "The Buddha's retinue has increased by 1, and ours has decreased by 1. At this, Mara's palace quakes. Thus, a bhikshu is one who frightens Mara. He also destroys the evils of the 84,000 afflictions because he has resolved his mind on Bodhi. These bhikshus were assembled together as a sangha. Sangha is a Sanskrit word which means harmoniously united assembly. They live together without bickering or fighting
and are united in terms of phenomena and noumena. In terms of the noumenal aspect, they have given proof to liberation and to the unconditioned. In terms of the phenomenal, they are united in six ways. 1. As a harmonious group, they dwell together. They don't look at one another's faults and fight among themselves. No one has a special style. There are, for example, no solitary drinkers or smokers out of harmony with the rest. Everyone who lives with the Sangha must abide by the Sangha's rules. 2. With harmonious speech, they do not quarrel. They don't gossip. They don't say, so-and-so has such and such an asset, and so-and-so has such and such a fault. Three frogs have six eyes. Their speech is harmonious, and what they talk about is important and has principle. They don't argue. 3. With harmonious thoughts, they enjoy the same things. One person likes to study the Buddha Dharma, and so does the next. One is vigorous, and the next is even more so. The more one person cultivates, the more the next cultivates. Everyone makes vigorous progress. Every day they are more energetic, not more lazy. Cultivating more and speaking less, their minds are in harmony. 4. With harmonious views, they have the same liberation. 5. With the same precepts, they cultivate together. 6. In harmony, they mutually share their benefits. 1,250 in all. These were the Buddha's constant followers, his retainers. When the Buddha went to lecture sutras, these arhats always went along, even if they had already heard the sutra. There were actually 1,255 disciples, but for the sake of convenience, the number was rounded off to 1,250. Where did the disciples come from? In the deer park, the Buddha first taught the five bhikshus. Then Yashas, the son of an elder, and his 49 disciples took refuge. The Venerable Shariputra and the Venerable Mahamudgalyayana each had 100 disciples who took refuge. That makes 255. The Kashyapa brothers had 1,000 disciples, making 1,255, and rounded off 1,250 in all. The three Kashyapa brothers had 1,000 disciples. 500 were with Uruvilva Kashyapa. Uruvilva means papaya grove, for it is said that he cultivated in a papaya grove. Some accounts claim that he had a lump on his chest which resembled a papaya, some describing it as concave and some as convex. What is probable is that he cultivated in a papaya grove and, liking to eat papayas, in time a papaya grew on his chest. Papayas are good for curing illnesses of the lungs. Uruvilva Kashyapa had two brothers, Gaya, meaning city, or Elephant Head Mountain, and Nadi, meaning river. The two brothers had 500 disciples between them, and so the three brothers had a total of 1,000 disciples. The Buddha first taught and crossed over the five bhikshus in the deer park. Then he considered who to cross over next. Seeing that the potential of the three Kashyapa brothers had matured, he went to the dwelling of Uruvilva Kashyapa. He could not, however, simply say, "I have come to save you, Uruvilva Kashyapa. Do you believe that?" He had to employ a clever expedient device, and so he said, "It's late, and I can't travel any farther. May I stay on here?" Uruvilva Kashyapa, a powerful fire worshipper, saw the Buddha and thought, Why is he so special?
Try as he might, he couldn't figure the Buddha out.
Strange, he thought. I can see anyone else's background just by looking. Why can't I see his?
Finally, he said to the Buddha, Very well, you may stay here. And he put him in a cave where Uruvilvakashyapa's protector, a dragon, lived. The dragon was extremely fierce and scorched to death anyone who came near him. In the middle of the night, the dragon tried to burn the Buddha, but the Buddha had entered the firelight samadhi and couldn't be burned. The Buddha put the dragon in his bowl. More than likely, he didn't have to trick him by saying, You can only make fire. You can't jump into my bowl. As the sixth patriarch would later speak to another dragon, You can only manifest a big body, not a small one. The Buddha used a very natural method to get the dragon into his bowl. Then he explained the Dharma to him, and the dragon took refuge. Seeing such spiritual penetrations and transformations, Kashyapa knew that his own virtue was not as great as the Buddha's. Thereupon, he took refuge and instructed his 500 disciples to do the same. Soon after leaving home, they gave proof to the sagely fruit. Kashyapa's two brothers were also fire worshippers, but when they saw that their brother had become a bhikshu, they wanted to leave home as well. They did, and along with their 500 disciples, they soon gave proof to the sagely fruit. That makes 1,255 disciples. Out of gratitude for the Buddha's deep kindness and his teaching, they were the Buddha's constant followers. No matter where the Buddha went, they accompanied him and protected the assembly. For example, here we lecture on the sutras, and those who come to listen protect the assembly. Even though they already understand the doctrines, they still take time from their busy schedules to come and listen. All great arhats whom the assembly knew and recognized. Arhat, a Sanskrit word, has three meanings which correspond to the three meanings of the word bhikshu, because being a bhikshu is the cause of attaining arhatship, and arhatship is the result of cultivation as a bhikshu. It's a matter of cause and effect. An arhat is 1. Worthy of offerings. On the causal ground, a bhikshu is a seeker of alms food, and in the result, he is worthy of the offerings of gods and men. 2. One without birth. A bhikshu frightens Mara, and in the result, as an arhat, he undergoes no further birth. 3. A slayer of thieves. On the causal ground, a bhikshu destroys evil, and in the result, as an arhat, he has slain the thieves of ignorance and afflictions. On the causal ground, the bhikshu frightens the demons of the five skandhas, the afflictions, and death. Death is also a demon. Some cultivators practice diligently, yet when they fall sick and confront death, they are afraid. I'm going to die, they cry, turned by the demon of death. Real cultivators fear nothing. They are not afraid of life, and they are not afraid of death. Life and death are the same. Death and life are not different. There is no distinction between them. If while alive cultivators can be as if dead, they will have no thoughts of desire. How can one have desire, greed, hate,
stupidity, pride, or doubt as a dead man. When one arrives at this state, there are no afflictions, no troubles at all. This is true happiness. This state is not easy to attain, however. On the other hand, it is not difficult either. If you want to, you can do it. For example, when one of my disciples became extremely sick, he said to me repeatedly, "I'm really suffering." I said, "The more suffering you undergo, the better. The more you suffer, the more you will understand." One day, it seemed as if he had died. He went to a happy place full of people. "Happiness is happiness," he said, "but I want to see my teacher." "Who is your teacher?" the people asked. As soon as they heard his teacher's name, they were unhappy. "You can't see your teacher here," they said. "Then I'm leaving," he said, and came back. He didn't die after all. You might say that he has conquered the demon of death. Subsequently, his skill has increased greatly. Whom the assembly knew and recognized. These arhats were all very famous, and their virtue was respected by the entire population. Everyone knew their names and recognized their faces. Sutra. Elders Shariputra. Maha Madgalyayana. Maha Kashyapa. Maha Katyayana. Maha Kaustila. Ravata. Sudimpantaka. Nanda. Ananda. Rahula. Gavampati. Pindola Bharadvaja. Kaladanyan. Mahakapina, Vakula, Aniruddha, and others such as these, all great disciples. Commentary. Elder is a term used to show respect for another's position. There are three kinds of elders. 1. Elders in age. 2. Elders in the Dharma nature. 3. Elders in blessings and virtue. An elder in age has lived for many years. A Dharma nature elder understands the Buddha Dharma and comprehends his self nature. Regardless of his age, he is nonetheless an elder in terms of his wisdom and intelligence. One such as this may be young in years, but he can lecture on sutras and speak the Dharma. His wisdom is limitless, and his eloquence is unobstructed. Elders in blessings and virtue are fortunate because people like to make offerings to them. Because of their virtuous conduct, they are fields where, by making offerings, one plants the causes of future blessings. Shariputra was a Dharma nature elder. At the age of 8, he studied and mastered all the Buddha Dharma in only 7 days, and he could out-debate all the Indian philosophers. His name is Sanskrit. His father's name was Tishya, and his mother's name was Sarika. Hence, he was known as Upatishya, Little Tishya, and as Shariputra, the son of Shari. The word Shariputra may be translated 3 ways. 1. Body, son, because his mother's body was extremely beautiful and her features very refined. 2. Egret, son, due to his mother's eyes, which were as beautiful as an egret's. And 3. Jewel, son, because her eyes shone like jewels. Shariputra's mother's eyes were beautiful, and when she bore this jewel-eyed son, his eyes were beautiful too. He was the foremost of the Shravakas in wisdom. While still in the womb, he helped his mother debate, and she always won. In the past, whenever she had debated with her brother, she had always lost. But while she was pregnant with Shariputra, her brother always lost. "This isn't your own power," he said. "The child in your womb must be incredibly intelligent. He is helping you debate, and that's why I lose." Thereupon, he decided to study logic and travel to southern India, where he studied for many years. There was no electricity at that time yet, but he studied by day and by night. He mastered the 4 Vedas, the classics of Indian knowledge, without wasting a moment. He didn't take time to mend his tattered clothing, wash his face, or even cut his nails, which grew so long that everyone called him the long-nailed Brahmin. Having mastered various philosophical theories, he returned to debate with his sister's son. He had spent a great deal of time preparing for the event and felt that if he lost, it would be the height of disgrace. "Where is your son?" he asked his sister. "Shariputra has left the home life under the Buddha," she said. The long-nailed Brahmin was displeased. "How could he?" he said. "What virtue does the Buddha have? He's just a Shramana. Why should anyone follow him? I'm going to bring my nephew back." He went to the Buddha and demanded his nephew, but the Buddha said, "Why do you want him back? You can't just casually walk off with him. Establish your principles, and I'll consider your request." "I take non-accepting as my doctrine," said the uncle. "Really?" said the Buddha. "Do you accept your view of non-accepting? Do you accept your doctrine or not?" Now, the uncle had just said that he didn't accept anything. But when the Buddha asked him whether or not he accepted his own view of non-accepting, he could hardly admit he accepted it, for that would invalidate his doctrine of non-acceptance. But if he said that he didn't accept it, he would contradict his own statement of his doctrine and his view. He was therefore unable to answer either way. Before the debate, he had made an agreement with the Buddha that if he won, he would take his nephew, but if he lost, he said that he would cut off his head and give it to the Buddha. The uncle had bet his head and lost. So what did he do? He ran. About 4 miles down the road, he stopped and thought, "I can't run away. I told the Buddha that if I lost, he could have my head. I'm a man, after all, and I should keep my word. It's unmanly to run away." Then he returned to Shakyamuni Buddha and said, "Give me a knife. I'm going to cut off my head." "What for?" said the Buddha. "I lost, didn't I? I owe you my head, don't I?" he said. "There's no such principle in my Dharma," said the Buddha. "Had you won, you could have taken your nephew. But since you lost, why don't you leave home instead? Will you accept me?" "Yes," replied the Buddha. So not only did the nephew not return, but the uncle didn't return home either. At age 8, the great wise Shariputra had penetrated the real mark of all dharmas in only 7 days, and defeated all the philosophers in India. When Shakyamuni Buddha spoke the Amitabha Sutra without request, Shariputra was at the head of the assembly because only wisdom such as his could comprehend the deep, wonderful doctrine of the Pure Land Dharmador. Not only was he foremost in wisdom, he was not second in spiritual penetrations either. Once, a layman invited the Buddha to receive offerings. Shariputra had entered samadhi, and no matter how they called to him, he wouldn't come out. He wasn't being obnoxious by showing off, thinking, "I hear them, but I'm not moving. That's all there is to it." No, he had really entered samadhi. When he didn't respond to the bell, Madgalyayana, foremost in spiritual powers, applied every bit of strength he had, but couldn't move him. He couldn't even ruffle the corner of his robe. This proves that Shariputra was not only number one in wisdom, but also in spiritual penetrations. He wasn't like us. If someone bumps us while we sit in meditation, we know it. Shariputra had real samadhi. We should look into this. Why was Shariputra foremost in wisdom? Why was he called the greatly wise Shariputra? It's a matter of cause and effect. In a former life, in the causal ground, when he first decided to study, he met a teacher who asked him, "Would you like to be intelligent?" "Yes, I would," said Shariputra. "Then study the Dharmador of Prajna wisdom. Recite the Great Compassion Mantra, the Sharangama Mantra, the 10 small mantras, and the Heart Sutra. Recite them every day and your wisdom will unfold." Shariputra followed his teacher's instructions and recited day and night while standing, sitting, walking, and reclining. He didn't recite for just one day, but made a vow to recite continuously, to bow to his teacher, and to study the Buddha Dharma life after life. Life after life, he studied prajna, and life after life, his wisdom increased until, when Shakyamuni Buddha appeared in the world, Shariputra was able to penetrate the real mark of all dharmas in only 7 days. Who was his former teacher? Just Shakyamuni Buddha. When Shakyamuni Buddha realized Buddhahood, Shariputra became an arhat, and because he obeyed his teacher, he had great wisdom. He never forgot the doctrines his teacher taught him, and soon, in 7 days, he mastered all the Buddha's dharmas. When one has not studied very much Buddha Dharma in the past, one learns mantras and sutras slowly. One may recite the Sharangama Mantra for months and still be unable to recite it from memory. It is most important, however, not to be lazy. Be vigorous and diligent. Like Shariputra, don't relax day or night. Those who can't remember should study hard, and those who can should increase their efforts and enlarge their wisdom. You should consider, why is my wisdom so much less than everyone else's? Why is his wisdom so lofty and mine so unclear? Why do I understand so little? It's because I haven't studied the Buddha Dharma. Now that we have met the Dharma, we should vow to study it. Then in the future, we can run right past Shariputra and study with the greatly wise Bodhisattva Manjushri, who is far, far wiser than the arhat Shariputra. This is the cause behind Shariputra's wisdom, a useful bit of information. Three American Shramaneras and two American Shramanerikas have now received the complete precepts. Shramanera, Bhikshu, and Bodhisattva precepts. You could say that they are new Bodhisattvas returning to America. People who have received the Bodhisattva precepts cultivate the Bodhisattva way, and people who have received the Bhikshu precepts uphold the Buddha Dharma and teach living beings. When these five return from Taiwan, we Americans should protect them as precious treasures. All of you should be their Dharma protectors, for they are returning to America to establish American Buddhism so that in the future, Americans will be able to cultivate and realize Buddhahood. This is my hope.